in the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, we will go, here's the order we'll do today. We'll do Senate Bill 7 first. And, Paul, do we have folks signed up for Senate Bill 7? Or our new assistant, Pam Levitt?
No one signed up for Senate Bill 7.
Oh, good. So we'll try to do 7 first, because usually once I open a public hearing, that draws the rest of the committee. And then we'll do Senate Bill 179, since I think there's a few folks here that want to testify on 179. Then 178, and then 180. So with that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 7. Massey, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Mr. Chair. How are you? Did you have a good weekend?
I did. I had a great weekend.
Well, I hope I could say, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, but Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 7 is a bonding bill that deals with our house here that we live in. It's for the Capitol building renovations for the both wings. Senate Bill 7 basically puts the renovation project into a revenue bond and gives the permission for this revenue bond to be let or sold by the state treasurer and through collaboration with DAS and the legislative administration to structure the bond in a way that would be illegal, but in the same time the amount of money is not clear in it. So that needs to be looked at. In addition, I think that the one issue that might need to be rehashed within the Senate bill is that the bonds are to be revenue bonds and they to be payable from the foundation account, the capital foundation money. However, the foundation does not have a revenue stream today that is consistent to make bond payments or debt service in a sense that it would have as you would define a normal type or regular type of bond. Thus, there is a suggestion, I guess, by the state treasurer, and I thought Laura is going to be here to propose these bonds to be in a mechanism of a COP, certificate of participation type of way. That way they will become payable and pay for the project from the general fund, and there'll be the mechanism of compensating the general fund from the foundation money in order to allow for the COPs, or somehow find that mechanism in order to make it financially feasible to do so.
Great. Thank you, Mazin. Anyone here wishing to testify on Senate Bill 7? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7. And as soon as we get two more members, do we need to go into recess? There's one. Hi, Senator George.
Get a quorum, Mr. Chair. Is that we're looking for a work session?
Yeah, we can't open a work session without.
We're recessing for the purpose of quorum?
Or maybe just pausing for a moment.
A young man that was rushing down the hallway, is that what we're doing?
We'll stand in recess. Chris, we can't open a work session until we get. A work session on Senate Bill 179. Chris, we heard this in January, and we've got folks who from the insurance industry that want to testify, but remind the committee what the issues are with Senate Bill 179.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 179 was proposed by the Department of Revenue and pertains to an issue around
apportionment factors.
Historically, the insurance companies have an equally weighted apportionment formula, property, payroll, and sales. And historically, when one or more of those factors have not been present, they adjust the denominator to divide accordingly. So if one of the factors wasn't there, they would just divide by two instead of three. Within the past year or so, they got some advice from the Attorney General that the statute wasn't entirely clear that that was the proper thing to do and that they should seek advice from the legislature. So they have proposed what has become Senate Bill 179, and the language that is in there codifies or clarifies the practice that they have been doing for a number of years to adjust by non-existent or factors that aren't present. And the revenue impact is a minimal impact because it would be a continuation of that, the procedures that they have been following for a number of years. And that's the 179. Would you like me to talk about the dash ones or just... What do you want to stick
well, let's do. So, Deborah, do you want to come up and talk about, just so the committee hasn't heard this bill in a few months, why the department introduced Senate Bill 179? And then we'll go to the dash ones and let Oregon Mutual and whoever else would like to talk about the dash ones.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. There were three issues that we were dealing with in Senate Bill 179. Two of them are related to the factors that insurance companies use, and then the other was addressing results of a court case from about a year ago. The two dealing with the factors are, number one, it isn't clear, or there's no provision that states if you end up with one factor being negative, how you deal with that. So that isn't a problem with normal corporations, but with insurance companies, they can actually end up with a negative factor. Our practice has been to place that negative at zero and to use zero, but it wasn't clear in the statute that that's what needed to be done. The other one dealing with the factor issue is whether when a company has one factor that's totally absent in its business, should you ignore that factor in doing the apportionment calculation? And that is what we have historically done. In fact, through the 2006 tax year, our instructions have said that if you don't have one factor existing in your business at all, then you ignore that factor in doing the calculation. So that's how you get to the division by two instead of by three. The third is the Stonebridge case that came last year. And the court in that case found that using the statutory factors resulted in an unconstitutional amount of tax imposed on that company. But the court said there's no alternative method allowed in the statutes. For regular corporations, there is an alternative. When you end up with an unconstitutional result, you can use some alternative method. There's nothing for insurance companies to use, and in that case, the court said the company owes no tax at all. So those were the three issues that were in Senate Bill 179 that we brought to you.
Great. Questions for the department? Or Chris?
This was about 3 years ago we heard this bill.
3 months.
Just seems like 3 years ago.
Yeah. So the options are do nothing, and the AG will probably involve themselves again in terms of providing clarity to the department. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, if nothing is done to clarify whether it should be three factors or two factors, we would go to the Attorney General's and ask for formal advice from them. I don't believe we have done that. Ask for formal advice as to what the statute means, and then if they say it should be three factors no matter what, then we would inform insurance companies of that and assume that those that filed and used two factors would be able to amend and seek refunds. If they say that it should be two factors, then we would act, and presumably if we're in an audit or examining a return and they have used three, we would adjust that to two. So we would need to seek some guidance from the Attorney General's office.
Or obviously pass the bill, and that provides the guidance that the department's looking for if the bill passes as written.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the bill in its original form does provide guidance, and when you're ready to discuss the Dash 1 amendments, I could speak to those too if you would like.
Great, and I think we have someone from the insurance division. Is that correct? So when we get to that, we may ask for some help.
Thank you.
Senator George, did you have a question?
No, I'll go ahead and wait till we're back on the dash ones.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Monroe.
Just my opinion is that we should not leave this to the Attorney General, but if there's an ambiguity in the law, that's what we're here for, is to deal with it.
Great. I'm sure the department's happy to hear that. Okay, so the dash ones. Chris, do you want to talk about the dash ones? And while we do that, I'll ask Oregon Mutual, who I believe is the sponsor of the dash ones, to address those. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash one, which you should have in your packet, essentially replaces the bill as drafted and substitutes language that would move insurance companies to a single sales factor, with the insurance sales being that one factor, and that would take for, effect for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2007. You also have in your packet a draft revenue impact statement related to the dash ones. And one of the issues around this is an interaction between the state's excise tax and its retaliatory tax, which is what somebody from the insurance division will speak to. But essentially, the single sales factor would treat foreign and domestic insurers a little bit differently. Domestic insurers are not subject to the retaliatory tax. So the foreign insurers, with going to a single sales, in net, they would experience an increase in the excise tax. This increase, because of the way the retaliatory tax is structured, would be largely offset by nearly corresponding reductions in the retaliatory tax. So it would be largely offsetting for the foreign insurance insurers. For the domestic insurers, because they don't pay the retaliatory tax, and they are expected to, in net, have a tax reduction, overall, there would be a decrease in general fund revenues.
And you have it somewhere, in the current information. Thank you. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. Steve Patterson. I'm the Vice President, General Counsel with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company in McMinnville, Oregon. We're here in support of Senate Bill 179-1. We still oppose Senate Bill 179. Just briefly, our opposition to 179, the court in that Stormbridge case said there was no other way to divide the pie other than dividing by three. So I think the court gave clarification in that case as to how the current law works. Senate Bill 179-1, as amended, would actually be a tax increase for Oregon Mutual. And we support this. First, we thank Senator George and his staff for helping us prepare and help us get this heard, as we do with you, Mr. Chairman. But with the exception of insurance companies, since January 2005, all other corporations are being taxed on a single sales factor. And so it's very simple. How much business do you do from Oregonians? And we're going to tax you on that basis. A little more complicated with insurance companies. We have two other factors. One of them is real estate income, and the other one is wages and commissions you pay in Oregon to Oregon agents, in our case, or employees. We have about 200 employees up in McMinnville, another 30 or so spread out through the rest of the state. The presence of those employees for Oregon Mutual in this state as our predominant servicing group of people that handle the other five states we work in actually is detrimental to us in the excise tax, because a majority of our wages and commissions are paid in Oregon, about 59%. When you take our sales, which are about 32%, and you add our wages and commissions, which are about 59%, and then you take our real estate income, which is zero, not because we choose to, but because if we get even $1 of rent out of any of our property, that factor becomes 100% because we don't own real estate and lease it out anywhere else. The wage and commission and the real estate income inflates our tax on the basis of sales. That average is somewhere around 49%. That would be our factor as a domestic insurer. If you use just the two, you get rid of the if you get rid of the real estate one, it's about 49%. If you add the real estate one in, it's currently 32%. If you went to a single sales factor, and I have in the testimony I prepared, there's a little chart on the second one. If you went to the single factor, it'd be 39.18%. So I'm not here proposing that this is a good bill because it's going to save us tax money. In fact, our taxes will go up probably 6%. And that may not be true for other domestic insurers. But I would submit that it's most fair and it's the best public policy to encourage insurance companies to locate their employees to pay commissions to Oregon workers in Oregon, to locate businesses to pay, you know, property taxes. Our employees are all paying state income tax. And so we think the current law sends the wrong message. We think Senate Bill 179-1 is the simplest, most fair way to tax insurance companies, as I think has been lauded for the taxation of most corporations. And that's why we're here in support of it. And I'd certainly be willing to answer any questions that the committee may have as far as our support of this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Questions for Mr. Patterson with Oregon Mutual? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Standard Insurance. How is it getting in and out of your offices? I know.
Actually, it's not too bad, Chair Deckard.
Oh, good.
They usually get one lane of traffic.
Flowing.
Yeah, so we can get in and out. Actually, they don't like to let us out, so we just
stay.
We just stay and work. Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Gwynn, and I am the officer in charge of taxation at Standard Insurance Company. With me today is Paul Goodwin, also from the Standard, and Director of Tax. This statement is on behalf of Standard Insurance Company, Oregon's largest domestic insurer and financial services company, an employer of over 2,200 employees in Oregon, and with a payroll of about $145 million. The Standard recently, as many of you may know, celebrated its 100th year anniversary as an Oregon-based company, and we pride ourselves on being involved in this community. Today, the Standard provides insurance and financial services to over 8 million Americans, including many groups and taxpayers in Oregon. As you consider Senate Bill 179-1, I believe, the company believes, it is important that you focus on four key points. First, non-insurance companies in Oregon are taxed using a single sales factor. Clearly, the same logic used by the legislature to change to a single apportionment factor should be applied to insurance companies. Thus, we consider this bill amendment as additional cleanup work from the original 2005 legislation. Second, over the last 15 to 20 years, which dates me as a tax professional, most states are moving to a single sales factor apportionment regimen in one form or the other. As states adopt these new requirements, it is clear that industry may end up apportioning more than 100% of its income to states in which we operate because there is no uniform apportionment applied among the states. For instance, this happens to Standard because we apportion our income to Oregon based on the three-factor apportionment computation, as opposed to, for instance, the state of Illinois, where we also do business, which requires we apportion our income based on a single sales factor. By not changing to a single sales factor, we are disadvantaged compared to an Illinois insurance company operating in Oregon. Third, auditing a single sales factor will be much easier for the Department of Revenue instead of auditing multiple sales for multiple factors, they will have to consider only one. And naturally, from an industry perspective, the preparation and energy devoted to preparing a tax return is easier for us. I'll admit that. And finally, we are in agreement with Mr. Patterson's argument, asking domestic companies to include not only wages and commissions paid in Oregon and real estate income and interest in our apportionment factors hits domestic insurance companies pretty hard. This system favors out-of-state insurance companies. Because of this, it prevents a financial disincentive to Oregon insurers who want to increase Oregon employees and investments. Unevenly imposing a tax liability on domestic insurers which employ Oregonians and invest in Oregon property is bad public policy and doesn't make economic sense for the state. I thank you for the opportunity to address you and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And, sir, did you have...
I agree with her.
And we appreciate the 100th anniversary of Standard in Oregon. Questions for... Yes, Senator George.
And we appreciate all those jobs in Oregon, too. I'm going to be reading something from previous testimony, and I believe what you just said, you would agree with this. I'll begin with this statement. Because the incentives in the system do not encourage insurers to invest in Oregon, the current excise tax law favors insurance operations that invest in most of the real estate office employees and other agents in other states while maximizing sales in Oregon. And do you agree that that's a true statement based on the current?
I apologize. Could you read that one more time?
Oh, okay. Basically, what the paragraph says is that because of the current excise tax law, that it favors insurance companies that would not invest in real estate offices, employees, or agents, but they would do that in other states, but their focus would then be in Oregon just to maximize the sales in Oregon.
I agree, sir.
Yes, thanks.
Other questions for Standard? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other folks that want to testify before we get to the insurance department on especially the dash ones? Okay, Deborah, do you want to come with, and I have a note here, Ms. Hadley, and I just can't read your name, Carl. Sorry, is it? So we have Ms. Lynette Hadley and Mr. Carl. Lundberg, it is Lundberg. And I believe you've come especially just to address the dash ones.
That's correct, Chair.
Go insurance first and revenue second. It's like a game of Monopoly. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Deckard. My name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Insurance Administrator for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I have with me Lynette Hadley, who is a retaliatory tax analyst for the Insurance Division and handles all the retaliatory taxes and can explain the intricacies of retaliatory tax and how the excise tax and the retaliatory tax work together so as to put money in the general fund or not, depending on how the relationship between the two works out on individual cases. Unfortunately, the way it's done on a company-by-company basis, and so you can make generalizations about how it works, but you can't. You have to actually look at all the detail in order to figure out exactly what the outcome would be of the Dash 1 amendments. Lynette Hadley has prepared some examples which are passed out, and with your permission, I would like to have her explain to you how those work.
That'd be great.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So Chris indicated that there might be questions about the retaliatory tax, and because of that, we did do some examples of how the retaliatory tax works. It's a very individualized company based on a company and how their tax structure works.
So, Ms. Hadley, if we could do this, I think it'd be helpful for clarity for the committee. So if we adopt the dash ones, if you could walk us through how two companies might be treated, and then the kind of the picture for the state of Oregon if we adopted the dash ones.
Okay. Why don't you look at, there's two sides to your sheet, and one says retaliatory tax. How is it affected by the change tax size? The first one is the XYZ insurance companies, and these are made-up numbers. Okay, it's a California company. It has currently a home state basis, which is a compilation of all of the taxes, fees, licenses that an Oregon company would have to pay in California. And we have a number there of $10,000. That's their premium tax, their fraud fee, all the other taxes that they might have. In Oregon, the XYZ company pays $6,000. And so they also pay a $4,000 retaliatory tax. Now, if you look, if excise goes up $1,000 due to the Dash 1 amendment, then they would still have the $10,000 in California. They would have now $7,000 in Oregon, in the Oregon basis. So that would bring retaliatory down $1,000. So they'd pay $1,000 more in excise, but they would pay $1,000 less in retaliatory. And then you can see I did some other examples. And it would, for each company, it's hard to say. It's not going to be like a 20% increase or a 10% increase. It's going to be based on their own sales figures, their own however their excise is calculated. And that's where the Department of Revenue keeps those taxes and tax returns and has those numbers. Say, for example, in our third little deal there, if the excise went up $7,000, our home state basis in California is the same, $10,000, but our Oregon basis went up to $13,000. So we have no retaliatory. So in that case, the excise goes up $7,000, but the retaliatory goes down $4,000. So that's a net gain to the general fund of $3,000. Then I did some that go down, but I guess from what we figured out, most foreign companies are going to experience an increase.
And do you know offhand how other states that are moving, and we did it pretty aggressively towards 100% single sales, how they treat insurance companies? Are we unique, or are we an aberration in that respect?
I think we are pretty unique in, and maybe Department of Revenue can speak to that better as far as the excise, but we are unique in the United States in that we're the only state in the union that has no premium tax other than the fire marshal. And so since we have no premium tax, when we compare with California that has a 2.35, or there's other states that have 3.5 or 1.25 or 1.75, they all have some premium tax. So when you look at a home state basis in California, in Massachusetts, in Illinois, they have usually more than we do because we don't have a premium tax to add into that.
More
taxes, fees, et cetera, that they've paid than we do. And so our retaliatory tax brings in about $61 million every year, so about $120 million on a biennium. So it's a substantial part. In addition to that, we also collect on the same tax return the fire marshal tax, which brings in between $6 and $7 million a year. So it's substantial.
Fire marshal, I mean, this is getting a little off, is assessed against insurance companies?
Yes. Fire marshal is a 1% premium tax assessed against fire premiums.
Oh, okay.
Which several lines of insurance have components that are fire, and then, of course, one line is straight fire insurance. But and that's the change we made a couple of years ago in legislature, that they changed that, how we do fire marshal. So
If I can just do one other, so I...
Your chair.
The problem is I'll forget it if I don't. And Deborah, you may know this also. For single sales states, states that are either an 80 or 100% on single sales, do you know offhand which ones include their insurance companies in the single sales formula and which ones don't? Or
I don't have that answer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I believe it, part of the uniqueness is that Oregon, because we don't have the premium tax, we're fairly unique in insurance companies being taxed under the excise tax. So the question almost doesn't apply in most cases because they're not charged the excise tax.
So they don't.
They're paying the premium tax.
Premium
instead.
Tax instead because it's.
I see.
Okay. And most states have a premium tax.
Yes.
Mr. Buchanan, or Senator George.
Thanks. You mentioned the $61 million in retaliatory tax recovery, but you also, I believe, indicated that the total that the state would recover from years of operation and taxes we would impose would probably be larger with dash ones. Is that correct? In other words, you...
Well, those are figures that really should be supplied by DOR. My component of it is the retaliatory tax, mm-hmm. and how much of an increase would be offset by a decrease in retaletory tax. Both taxes go to the general fund. So it's kind of like you're taking in more on one side, but you're losing some on the other side. And the question is, how much?
But in the examples, we seem to be showing a slight gain.
It is my feeling that there will be a gain in overall revenue to the general fund. Even with a decrease in domestics, I think DOR has numbers that will substantiate that the domestics will feel a reduction in tax, but the foreign insurers will have a greater increase in tax with some compensation from the retaliatory tax decrease. But overall, I believe there will be a tax gain to the general fund. Since they keep comprise some figures and I keep some figures, then we don't really have and it has to be done, the analysis has to be done almost on a company-by-company basis to be able to tell you for sure what the revenue increase or loss would be.
So will that be important information? We got a draft of a revenue impact that suggests perhaps it would be a net loss. But if revenue and LRO and insurance could get together, that'd be important to know that if we adopted the dash, obviously we have to include it in our budgetary process either way.
I follow my question.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would appear to me that we're talking about the dash one's a very simplified system. And the other would appear to us, because we're trying to get our hands around how exactly this works, a very complex system. Now, my experience in complex systems is normally they cost everybody money. So do we have any way to estimate what kind of savings would be realized by going to the Dash 1 proposal? Is that something you guys could possibly do a calculation? Because in audits and everything else, to me, there could be savings here. And so if we start to net money on the top just by the tax alone, even considering that, and then you have savings not only for those preparers, but also those of us who are government that is responding, revenue is responding to audits and that sort of thing, that there could be significant savings.
Chair Deckard, Senator George, there probably could be, but it's difficult without analyzing the entire process if you're... It would take a long time for us to do the measurements in order to time measurements to see how much would be saved. But it's logical to say that there would be some savings if you're doing a less complicated calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Senator Monroe. Anything for the Department of Insurance?
No, I want to hear from Deborah.
Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again for the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, we could administer the Dash 1 amendments. What they don't do is deal with two of those issues that we brought forward in the original bill. Number one, they apply for tax years starting 1-1 of 07, so they don't provide guidance as to prior years as to whether you want us to use two factors or three factors. Mr. Patterson spoke about the Stonebridge case clearly saying that you divide by three, and he's correct. That it was division by three, but all three factors were present in that case. The company had real and tangible property, and that they had premiums, and they had payroll. Mm. So it's really not on point to the issue. What we're talking about is if the company did not have one of those factors in its business at all, do you ignore the factor or not? And then also the amendments don't deal with alternative apportionment language. It's possible that we'll never have another Stonebridge case if you go to just using a single factor. But if we did have a case and we get to an unconstitutional result, again, there would be no alternative language to use a different apportionment factor. So those are the two things that are missing from the Dash 1 amendments that are in the original bill.
In the Stonebridge case, I should remember this, but Stonebridge, who was the litigant in that?
That was the Stonebridge Life Insurance Company.
Life Insurance. And that was adjudicated?
This was in the Oregon Tax Court in early 2006.
2006.
Decided February of 2006.
Okay. Yes, Senator George.
Deborah, I would like to go out of here thinking we really did something well. I have some notes in my file here from different representatives of insurance companies saying, you know, if we can't get something good, let's just not pass this thing. And that I kind of think that's kind of a consensus. So I believe we need to solve the problem, and we need to eliminate discrimination against Oregon-based companies. What would stop us from coming back, your folks operating with us, to come up with a Dash 2 that would include the solutions that you just mentioned to our current status?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we would have no problem with that.
Let's do it.
Other thoughts or questions for this panel? Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking along the lines of my colleague here. I would like to end discrimination against Oregon-based companies. If anything, we ought to be treating them more favorably than the foreign companies. And we need to fix the whole problem, not just one portion of it. So if amendments can be drafted by the department that accomplishes that, I think that would be a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad we rescheduled 179. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming this morning. It was to get these issues back before us and see if we can't find a direction or no direction to go in. And so we'll pursue at least having some of the parties meet, talk again, and see if there's a Dash 2 out there to be had.
Senator Monroe. Yeah, and one final caveat I would have is I don't want to see a revenue reduction. We have many needs in this state, and so if it has a substantial revenue loss to the state, I'd be concerned as well.
And so, Chris, the insurance division seemed to think that perhaps it would not. So if we could, we'll make that part of whatever. I'm just so against using the words work group, so I'm just not going to say it. But some collection of people who gather to discuss this, and I'll try to help get that group together, and we'll help Department of Revenue and the Insurance Division and some of the affected companies will be there. Close. Anyone else on 179? I know folks who have other jobs might have come down for this, so anything else on 179 before we close the work session? Ted, you were just scratching your nose, not that. close the work session on it's like an auction. You'll end up before us. Close the work session on 179. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming to the Capitol. Okay, let's reopen the work session on Senate Bill 178. Chris, where did we leave this bill?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This was the bill that dealt with the definition of unitary business. Traditionally, what's in the current statute, there are three factors to identify business as unitary, and they are a centralized management or common executive force, a centralized administrative services or functions resulting in economies of scale, and a flow of goods, capital resources, or services demonstrating functional integration. Historically, the department has used treated all three of those factors as being necessary. This bill would simply change the and to an or, and there was testimony presented last time that MTC proposed some uniform regulations in 2004 to that effect, and the Oregon Tax Court ruled in 1993 that not all three conditions needed to be met to satisfy the definition of a unitary business. It was one of the concerns was that the bill was not prospective. It went back to some open years under audit. There is a dash one amendment that simply changes that language so that it would only be prospective. It would only take effect for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2007. And that the revenue impact is minimal.
Mr. Chair. Senator Starr.
We're in work session.
Yeah, can I
move the amendment?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that since it's been a few months before we do that, department and Mr. Martinez, I'm just going to look at you because you're the one I talked to. Ready to go on dash ones, still retains the minimal revenue impact with the dash ones. Nods. Senator Starr.
Move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 178.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 178. Discussion. Objections. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. I apologize to Senator George for stumping on his territory there.
That's all right. I'm going to give you the bill.
Yeah, that's the way to get the bill. Senator Starr's moved Senate Bill 178 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Senator Starr, thank you for helping with that. How was the World Tour, by the way?
I couldn't play.
Oh, okay. I couldn't either. So I can't give you grief about that. Open a work session on Senate Bill 180. And Chris, again, the bill, and then we have dash twos, dash threes,
and dash one.
And the dash one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill is pretty straightforward. It adopts a uniform definition of financial organization. Currently in statute, there are two different definitions that have presented some problems in terms of consolidated returns filed at the federal level. In order to do so, all of the organizations in a consolidated return must meet the definition of financial organization. In some cases, under Oregon law, some organizations do not, such as mortgage bankers and brokers, and then they would need to file a separate and distinct tax return. The point of the goal of the bill was to clarify the language so that there would just be the one uniform definition of financial organization, and in these cases, they would be able to file as part of the consolidated return. Now, the dash one amendments, they're very similar. The dash one provides, it does two things. It makes some language, minor changes in the language to exclude credit unions. Credit unions were not meant to be part of this law change. And in the original drafting of the bill, there was some concern that the language would include the credit unions. So the dash one makes it clear that they would not be subject to the bill. And it also modifies the time, the effective date for the bill. It simply makes it prospective beginning tax years for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2007. So that's the dash one. The dash two simply changes the definition or modifies the definition of financial organization more directly so that it excludes credit unions. So the goal of the dash two is the same as part of the goal of the dash one. And then the dash three simply makes the bill prospective. It eliminates the language that would make it effective for returns that are amended or open to audit. They would just be effective for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2007. So you kind of have a there's a choice here. The dash one and the dash two could be taken together. The dash three is entirely contained in the dash one. because the dash 3 just changes that effective date.
So the dash 3 does not deal with the whole credit union issue of definition of a credit union. The dash 2 deals with everything.
The dash 2 does not deal with the effective date.
Effective date. So that is...
And I believe some... Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, questions for Chris, and I'm going to ask Deborah to also come up.
Yeah, it sounds to me like if we want to do both of these things, we need either the 1 and the 2 or the 2 and the 3. And I'd like to hear from Deborah as to what's the preferred way to go, what's the cleaner language.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. My opinion is that the dash 1 and the dash 2 taken together should deal with the concerns, and you would not need the dash 3. Doing the dash 2 and the dash 3 would not pick up the changes that the dash 1 have on lines 1 and 2, so there might still be some ambiguity by not changing that current law.
Can you say that again?
By not picking up the language in the dash 1 on lines 1 and 2, there could still be some ambiguity left in 317.080. I think that ambiguity goes away if you do the dash 1 and the dash 2, Mr. Chairman.
And are there any current cases, the whole issue of prospective, any cases that we ought to be aware of? Or I understand folks' interest in not looking backwards, looking forward.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any cases in particular. I can see that the issue would come up for years prior to 2007, but we would do what we have done under the law as it exists now, which is to simply tell them that if they have an entity in the federal consolidated return that doesn't meet the current law definition, they would need to file a separate return for that company or that corporation. So
the law would be roughly the same.
Right. So we can deal with it. It should not be a problem in that respect.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
I'm ready to move anytime you are.
I am too. So the other questions for the department, I would assume credit unions are good to go as long as we don't. Yes.
I was just looking.
I'm not going to step on his toes again.
You did step on my toes.
Well, I was going to get Dewey up here and make him testify. He hasn't testified enough this session. Yes, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate bill will move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 180. Yes.
Senator George has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 180. Discussion. Objections.
Now the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 180.
Senator George has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 180. Discussion. Objections. Senator George.
Move Senate Bill 180 as amended with the dash 1 and dash 2 before we do pass recommendations.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 180 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Who would like to carry that bill? Senator Monroe will carry the bill. We are adjourned until 8:45 tomorrow. Thank you, committee.